They had told us the night before, there's a small creek that you could just splash through. Your feet might get wet. We get to that little creek and it was
a river.
It was a torrent. And we could not figure out how to get across that. Well, John,
the great part was, if I remember correctly, Matt, you and I decided that we would just see whether or not we could somehow get across. And I remember taking like two steps into that river and you stepped in behind me. And the girls are yelling.
We are freaking.
The girls are screaming.
Telling me to get out. And I'm like, well, I would if I could turn around without falling down.
It was such a stupid thing to do.
This is the Dear Bob and Sue podcast, our stories of adventures and misadventures as we travel to all the U.S. national parks and public lands. I'm Karen Smith.
And I'm Matt Smith. We're the authors of the Dear Bob and Sue series of books. Today we're talking about our backpacking misadventure on the Chilkoot Trail in Alaska. I'm detecting a pattern here with regard to our Alaska experiences. They never go the way we plan.
Never. I know. I'm almost afraid to go back because I never know what's going to be in store for us. So this 33-mile Chilkoot Trail is north of Skagway, and it crosses into British Columbia, Canada. Now, back in the late 1800s, it was a major access route for those making their way to the Klondike goldfields in the Yukon Territory.
So this trail is a challenge even in the best conditions. But we wanted to do it, and we were lucky to have our friends John and Lolly join us on this trip. And let's just say the adventure was more than any of us bargained for.
That's an understatement. Now, because we have so much to talk about in this episode, we're skipping our usual intro and our mailbag segment. And due to time constraints, we had to condense our story a bit. But if you'd like additional information about the Chilkoot Trail and our adventure, we cover a lot more details in our book, Dear Bob and Sue, Season 3. So now let's dive right in. We have a lot to talk about today, Matt.
Yes, we do.
Today's episode is going to be about our huge misadventure hiking the Chilkoot Trail up in Alaska.
We did that a couple years ago with our friends John and Lolly, and it kind of all got started by a visit to the Klondike Gold Rush Historical National Park. A lot of words there.
Big mouthful.
Office, I guess you'd call it, or site in downtown Seattle.
Right. It was when we were going to all the parks and we suddenly realized that there was this National Park Service site right here in downtown Seattle. So we went to see it, not really knowing anything about the Klondike Gold Rush, at least I didn't. So it was a pretty fascinating couple of hours we spent there.
Right. And you, like you do often when we go to National Park sites, you made me sit through the interpretive movie that they show. And I think that was it. That sealed our fate. Once you saw the movie.
This whole journey and story would not have happened had we not sat and saw that, I don't know what it was, maybe a 20-minute movie that they showed in the little theater there. So that talked about hiking the Chilkoot Trail, which is something, of course, that the gold rushers did back in the late 1800s. But then we found out it's something you can actually do today.
So a little bit of history of what the heck the Klondike Gold Rush was and what the Chilkoot Trail is. Back in 1896, gold was discovered in the Yukon Territory on the Klondike River, up by a town called Dawson City. Very remote area. And this was about, 50 years after the California Gold Rush, and people were scouring the earth for new finds of gold, and prospectors all over the mountains and hills everywhere in the world, and a few prospectors found gold. Now, the Yukon Territory is winter most of the time. So there's a very short period of time that you can get up there. And so these gentlemen and one of the gentlemen's wives discovered gold in August of 1896, and it took them until really the summer of the next year to get the gold out of the ground that they wanted and get back to the lower 48. And they landed in San Francisco in July of 1897 and proceeded to get off the boat with, at the time, was over $1 million worth of gold.
Wow.
So today that would be anywhere from $100 to $200 million worth of gold. And it was a matter of days before the news got across the United States and the gold rush was on. Everyone was headed to Dawson City. And at the time, the United States was in a pretty bad economic recession. So there was a lot of people out of work. They were had nothing better to do. And the prospect of finding gold was pretty interesting. So they just took off for the Klondike. Now, the city of Seattle did a smart thing. They started advertising right away that Seattle would be the place you'd want to go in order to start your journey. You would come to Seattle, get all your supplies, get a boat ride up to Alaska, and start your journey to the Klondike. And as a result, they got really most of the traffic.
And they were competing with the other coastal cities of which ones?
Vancouver, British Columbia, and San Francisco, and Portland, and Tacoma, Washington. And so they did a good job of marketing, and they got a lot of prospectors to come through. So to get to Dawson City, there was several ways to get there. One is there was an all-ocean route. If you were rich and had some money, you could take a boat all the way to Dawson City because you would go around kind of through the Bering Strait and then up the river. Now, the problem with that is it took longer and it was more expensive. The most popular route was take a boat up to Skagway, Alaska, and the little town of Dyea, which is right next to Skagway, is where you would begin a journey up over the mountains, this Chilkoot Pass or this Chilkoot Trail. And then once you got up to the top there, you would build a boat, literally cut trees down, build a boat, get on Lake Bennett and start floating your way 500 miles to Dawson City. Now, there was a couple of other competing routes. There was the White Pass that came right out of Skagway proper. But Chilkoot was really the most popular. And so that's where a lot of the prospectors went. Now, they think that about 100,000 people headed towards the Klondike. About 30,000 to 40,000 people made it. They estimate maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people actually found gold and a few hundred got rich. Mm-hmm. So this was a risky proposition. And some of the people just did it for an adventure.
Well, I was just going to say what was fascinating to me, we read a lot of books about the subject before we went up to Alaska. And what was fascinating to me was that people from all walks of life flocked up there to the gold fields. I mean, there were doctors who, you know, in Philadelphia, who just literally quit their practices and headed to Seattle. People from Europe, people from all over the world were just fascinated by the sense of adventure and, of course, the promise of finding gold.
And a lot of people were up there just as entrepreneurs to make money off of the people who are going up there. I think that little town of Dawson City, before they struck gold, had about 500 people, and it quickly went up to 30,000 within a year. And what's interesting is, as you know, people even today, 120 years later, know what the Klondike Gold Rush is, mm-hmm. or have heard of it. It only lasted about a year because the prospectors got up there, they found it was harder to find gold than they thought. And then in 1899, there was gold found in Nome, Alaska. So everyone just flocked to Nome. So they were going from place to place. But the interesting part for us was that initial trail, that 33-mile trail that started from Dyea, Alaska, up over the Chilkoot Pass, today is actually a national park. So you can hike it, and now it's half in the U.S., half in Canada. You hike to this summit, and really at the summit is the Canadian border, and then you hike the rest of the way to finish the trail. And when we learned this story, both the history and the adventure of hiking a a cool trail in the wilderness. We just had to go.
We did. And it's called the meanest 33 miles in history. I guess lots of tales of adventure. And so it was a little bit intimidating, I'm not going to lie, but it was also very exciting. And we, you know, we took probably, what, a year or two to prepare for, right, both mentally and physically, and trying to figure out what we should bring. So yeah, we're going to talk about that today and kind of explain the whole adventure slash misadventure.
Well, the logistics are a little tough, mm-hmm, because there are so many moving parts, especially, you know, if you're coming from the lower 48. I mean, first of all, you have to get permits. And again, the window to hike the trail is pretty short. What would you say, like mid-June to early September?
Yeah, definitely the best weather is, you know, June, July, and August. And that is when you need the permit so they can manage the crowds. But the trail is open year-round. You know, of course, it's buried under snow for many of those months. But
and we wanted to hike it without snow. I mean, just well, what's interesting, a little, you know, back to a little bit of the history, in order to get to Dawson, because that 500-mile raft trip took so long, those prospectors had to hike it in the spring. So March and April generally was the big rush. And they were hiking it in deep, deep snow. Mm-hmm. But we didn't want that authentic of an experience. So
no.
So we decided to, we ended up getting some permits for early August. Parks Canada, even though half the park is in the U.S. and half is in Canada, Parks Canada is the institution that issues the permits for both sides, mm-hmm, for all the campgrounds. And so they generally take reservations starting in mid-January. And they post every year what day it is. And mm-hmm, you call them, literally call them, leave a message, and they'll call you back.
Right.
And you book your campsites. You had done a lot of research about what exact campsites we wanted. We decided to do it, what, in 4 nights?
Mm-hmm.
5 days, 4 nights?
Yeah, it's totally up to the individual how far you want to hike each day. We did talk to a ranger up at the visitor center in Skagway, and she recommended 4 nights, 5 days. And she said one important tip, which I think most people try to follow, is there's on the, usually it's the third day when you summit, it's a very difficult day of hiking, very steep, long day. So you want to stay at campsites closest to either end of that day. So Sheep Camp is sort of at the bottom of the summit, and Happy Camp is the next one after you summit. So we knew we wanted those two campsites, and then we just sort of worked out from there.
Yeah, we did. On our trip, and of course you could do this however you want, but our first night was Canyon City, which made that first day about 7.7 miles. Then Sheep Camp, which was another about 5.5 miles. And then Summit Day, from Sheep Camp, we went to Happy Camp, and that was the plan. That would have been about 7.5 miles. And then the last day would be 8.5 miles.
The 8.5 miles was to the campsite Loon Lake.
Okay, that's mm-hmm, right. Yeah, we went to Loon Lake. Mm-hmm. And then from Loon Lake, you would hike to a little town of Bennett, the end of the trail.
And where you pick up the train, and that was going to be about 4 miles.
So that was the plan. Now, getting the permits is only the first step in all the logistics. So now, once you have the permits, you have to figure out a way to get up to Skagway. You have to figure out lodging the night before, the night after, these kinds of things. What we ended up doing is we flew from Seattle to Juneau. We took, later on that same afternoon, we took a ferry, Alaska Fjord Lines, from Juneau up to Skagway.
Right, because commercial airliners do not fly into Skagway. You have to take a small plane, which I'm
right,
kind of over that.
Yeah, well, the small planes are commercial, but
I mean, a big commercial jet,
right,
airliner.
Yeah, the little tiny planes will fly you to Skagway. We took a ferry, spent the night at a little bed and breakfast called the White House in Skagway, and then the next day. Of course, once you come off the trail, you have to get your train tickets from where you leave the trail back to Skagway. And so that's the White Pass Railroad.
Right.
So you get the train tickets, and that doesn't, the train doesn't run every day.
Or... Yeah. So you have to make sure you come out on the correct day, because the train doesn't run 2 days a week. So you don't want to come out and be sitting there and there's no train. Also, we were just imagining in our minds, it's a scenic railroad train that takes people from Skagway, you know, cruise line people and things on a scenic tour, and then they make a stopover to pick up the hikers, and they put all the hikers in a special car.
Right, like a cattle car, like yeah. Just to air them out.
That's right. No one has had a shower now in like 5 days and is wet and dirty usually. So the hikers get a special car on the White Pass Railroad.
And you can also order a box lunch, which I'm sure is the best meal. It's going to certainly feel like or taste like the best meal you've ever had. So take the train back. And unless you have a way, you know, back home from Skagway that afternoon, you got to have lodging there in Skagway. And then, of course, travel back. And so we just did the opposite. We took the ferry from Skagway back to Juneau and flew Juneau to Seattle. So that's a lot of detail on the logistics. However, you have to know all these things. And it's a little bit of a puzzle to get all of these, because – you start with the permits, and then you hope that you can get these other reservations. We were fortunate enough to get them all, and it'll make more sense later in the podcast. But you know, this all had to happen just all lockstep. There was no room in the schedule for to skip a day or take an extra day on the trail or whatever, right?
Right. So. But you were on it. I mean, as soon as you got those permits, you literally sat down and started fitting all the rest of the pieces of the puzzle in.
Right. I wanted it done so we didn't have to worry about it. And once it was all done, then we could start thinking about, are we in physically the right shape? You know, how heavy are our packs going to be? What exactly should we take?
Let's talk about those packs for a minute, because I got a little worried when you brought home a scale and you started weighing all the things that were going to go in your pack, including, like, I remember you weighed your chapstick and I believe you weighed your spork.
Well, at the time, we were maybe 6 months into our backpacking career. We had done some backpacking trips the summer before, and we had others for that same summer. And like we at that point knew how grueling it can be to have an overweighted pack on a backpack trip. And we knew that this hike, especially Summit Day, would be challenging. And we still hadn't figured out the weight of our packs. And we hadn't figured out how to get the weight down.
And we found out when we got to the Seattle airport for our flight. And of course, we checked these packs and they weighed them. And I think, Matt, yours weighed 44 pounds and mine weighed 38. Mine was less because you always carry the tent and the jet boil and the water filter. So there's some of the things that you carry that I don't.
Still too heavy. 44 is still too heavy.
But I mean, talk about heavy packs. Those prospectors going up to the gold fields, I mean, their supplies, wait, what were they required? It was 1,000 pounds?
Well, it turned out to be pretty much, it would be at least 1,000 pounds. So what was happening at the time is people were just rushing to the Klondike or Dawson City thinking that, well, I'll just buy supplies and food when I get there. And the Canadian government was so concerned that they would have 20, 30, 40,000 people essentially stuck in Dawson City during freeze-up over the winter, and they would basically starve to death because they wouldn't bring the supplies. There wouldn't be enough food in Dawson City. And so they quickly instituted this rule that says, if you're going to cross into Canada, going to Dawson City to look for gold, you had to have a year's worth of food with you. And so essentially, you know, your flour and your bacon and the beans and all that stuff, your sourdough starter and those things you had to take with you. So you can imagine a single prospector has 1,000 to, let's say, 1,200 pounds of stuff that they have to take. They didn't just hike up the Chilkoot Trail once like we were planning to do. They would have to take 50 to 80 pounds, put it on their back, and hike up maybe 3-4 miles, 7 miles, drop it on the ground and go back. And they would do this maybe 15, 20 times for every stage of the trail. So what? It would take them months.
Yeah, I read that it took, on average, it took them 3 months to go basically the 33 miles that we're going to hike, just because they had to schlep load by load. And it was interesting because we were wondering before we read about it, how did they keep people from stealing their stuff when they would drop off a load and then go back? Like,
well, they had a very easy way of keeping people from stealing your stuff. If when you got to Skagway and you borrowed somebody's supplies without asking them, they basically shot you or strapped you to a log and whipped you in public. And so the vigilante justice was pretty harsh and swift. And quickly people realized that, you know, you're not supposed to take other people's stuff, even to the point where people would cache their supplies up the trail. And like I said, literally like make a pile on the ground. And for those prospectors who, let's say, gave up and just left their stuff there, no one touched it.
Because they were afraid.
They were afraid. So no one was really messing with each other's gear. And that's how they kept the justice on
wow.
the trail.
Yeah, that's crazy. So on the day that we left, it basically took us all day to get up to Skagway. We flew from Seattle to Juneau. Then we had about 4-hour wait there until the boat sailed from Juneau to Skagway. So we killed some time and then took the boat up, and that was a few hours, and we ended up getting up there. Gosh, it was like 9 o'clock at night by the time we got up to Skagway.
Yeah, so we got to the White House and spent the night, our last night in a sleeping on a mattress.
Yeah, gosh, I know. It was
last chance for a shower.
That's right. And then the next day, we weren't in a huge hurry to take off. They have mandatory orientations at the Trail Center in Skagway that you have to attend before you set off. And they had them every 2 hours, 8, 10, noon, and so on. So we decided that we'd go to the 10 o'clock one. And then when that was over, we'd set off on the hike. But they want to make sure they talk to you about trail etiquette and about, you know, they want to make sure you have your passports with you for the Canadian side. And they also talked to us about some bears.
There was a bear that particular summer. There was a bear that was hanging around part of the trail. And matter of fact, they had closed the trail a couple of times because the bear was just getting a little too friendly with hikers. Fortunately, I think it was that morning, they finally lifted the restriction and they said that bear had not been seen in a few days, so they lifted the restriction of that part of the trail. And but there are quite a few bears on the trail.
There are, and so that brings us to the topic of bear spray. So we couldn't fly up there with our bear spray. We definitely wanted to each have a canister. So our original plan was we would just buy some in Skagway when we got there. But fortunately for us, a woman who follows us on Instagram named Cheryl, she had seen some of our posts about hiking the Chilkoot Trail, and she emailed us and said that she and her husband, Troy, are the campsite hosts at the campground in Dyea every summer, and that she would love to meet us, and they could give us a ride from Skagway to the trailhead. And she also offered that they could scrounge up 4 canisters of bear spray for us. So it was so nice, and we took them up on it. So that's how we got to the trailhead also. Troy picked us up.
Right. And the drive from Skagway to Dyea is, what, 10 minutes? It's not that far, but it's too far to walk.
Right. And Dyea was once one of the ports that all the boats came into. And it was a little boom town back right then in the gold rush. Now they consider it a ghost town.
Right. There's not much there.
Not much there except the trailhead. So when Troy picked us up and then took us to the trailhead, of course, they have the national park sign, the Chilkoot Trail sign. So Cheryl met us there, and we all took photos. You know, we took photos with them and John and Lolly. And so it was very exciting. I just remember I was
We were very excited to get
nervous
going.
And excited. And then once we had all of our photos taken, it was finally time to hike the Chilkoot Trail. After dreaming about doing this hike for 10 years and planning it for another year, finally, we stepped foot on the Chilkoot Trail. Matt and I thought it would be great to talk about what happened next with the two people who experienced this adventure with us, John and Lolly. Welcome to the Dear Bob and Sue podcast.
Hello.
I don't know that this is a good idea.
It's not a good idea.
This is going to be herding cats for the next. So listeners, settle in for the next 6 hours. Mm-hmm. We'll have just
also, we would like to apologize in advance for anything that John might say that's inappropriate.
We'll try to edit it out. Yeah, so we were just getting on the trail. We took our photos. Troy had dropped us off. We took our photos, and we just got on the trail. And it was kind of, I think it was a little bit of a bad omen that, like, literally as we started hiking, it started raining.
I did have complete rain gear on, head to toe, mm-hmm. backpack covered in rain gear for the backpack.
So was your pack heavier than you, like when you started hiking, was like, oh my goodness, this pack is way too heavy?
My pack is always heavy because I bring way too much wine.
What I thought was kind of also different than I expected is I kind of thought that first hike, even though it was 7.7 miles to Canyon City, I thought, well, this is kind of a PUD hike, wouldn't be very hard, and like almost right off, it was steep.
That was that huge hill with all the roots sticking out.
Yeah,
remember
what's it called?
That
hill has a name.
Heart Attack Hill.
Hill.
I don't know. It's something
Did
like
you
that.
Just make that up.
I think. Yeah, we're going to make a lot of stuff up today. Just bear with us.
I don't know how far we'd gone, but remember we were on that really nice boardwalk over the swamp, the beaver ponds, and then all of a sudden.
Yep.
Yeah, we were like, "This is brand new. This is really nice of them to put this here for us to walk on." And then all of a sudden, boom.
It just ends.
Ends right in the middle of a lake.
It's like a dock that goes out into the lake, and then, like, what are we supposed to do now?
I know. No one told us about that.
No, I think we kind of just sat there looking, and we thought, well, okay, and down we go.
Into the water, into the...
Knee deep.
Yeah, with our hiking boots.
Yeah, we had to make a decision. We kind of all... I think we all had, like, some kind of water shoes. I know I had Crocs with me, and we didn't know, well, like, should we take our boots off, and then... to keep them dry the whole trip. And we just, like, none of us did that. We just all went in with our hiking boots.
Yeah.
In hindsight, we probably should have camped right there.
We should have gone back to Skagway, gone to the brewery and ordered.
Distillery that we found. By the way, I think I'll pour myself a glass of wine. Thank you.
Please do, Lolly. I know we got a late start because we thought it was going to be easy and quick, and we didn't realize that by the time we got to Canyon City Camp, that all of the good campsites would be taken.
Yeah, that was a little surprise. I thought we were, like, kind of in the middle of the pack.
I did too.
But we were kind of late at the end of the pack, and there was just one, well, what we thought was just one campsite left. It turns out there was others closer to the warming hut that were
the toilet.
They were actually right next to the latrine. Right. Yeah. That's why I passed.
Yeah. So we had this one site where it was just enough for our two tents. But, like, the river was right, like, literally at the edge of our site, and it was maybe, like, 2 inches from the bank. Like,
yeah, and considering how hard it was raining, we knew it was going to keep rising.
Yeah, and it was furious, remember? I mean, it was roaring, that Taya River. Yeah.
But what I really liked about that first campsite, it was a party scene. Everybody was just so happy to be out there. We're all soaking wet. We're wringing our socks in the warming hut. And
everyone at that stage, you're kind of all in it together.
Yes.
Because you've hiked 7-8 miles. You're in the rain. And then there's this warming hut that's at the Canyon City campground. And inside there's, like, this little potbelly stove. And every square inch of the warming hut had a wet sock or a wet boot or a wet jacket. Like, everyone had their stuff hung up, and there was kind of an interesting camaraderie in that warming hut.
It was a total waste of time.
trying to stay warm
and
wet?
Ride the whole trip.
That's right.
Yeah, the warming hut. Yeah. It was warm, though.
But it was packed. packed. I mean, there wasn't a place to even, like, can I have that little tiny inch to hang my one sock?
And remember, there were a couple of beds in there that I don't think anyone ever slept in. I don't know. Maybe people did.
But you were looking around looking at this crew because you knew we were going to be hiking with them the whole way over.
Right. So that's a good point, is that these, you know, it sells out. Like, the permits for every campsite sells out. And so this was maybe what? About 40 to 42 hikers, and you kind of are all going up this trail together.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, yeah, you're right. For the next few days, we're all kind of in this together.
Mm-hmm. And that was our introduction to our, what would become our German friends. Right. How many do you think there were? Like seven?
Seven or, yeah.
Well, they had a guide. So I think there were probably six of them in a guide.
Uh-huh. And they were out there smoking their cigarettes. They were out there smoking. Drinking some beer. They had their packs. Instant friends.
Instant friends.
I don't know anybody that hauls cans of beer on a 33-mile hike, unless you're going to drink it all in the first mile.
Yeah, so. I was a little envious of that.
And so we get into our tents, and we were wondering, right, if we're going to, is that river going to come up over the bank and kind of flood us out? But we had, actually, I think I had a pretty good night's sleep that night.
I had a pretty good night's sleep.
And the river, you weren't worried, John, about the
I was worried about the river. You guys don't know this, but it did come up, but I threw sandbags down and saved all you guys.
Thank you, John. The snoring coming out of
both tents was unbelievable. But you're welcome.
John, and we never knew.
Well, you were kind of ailing on the trip, John, as I remember. You had a bad hip, so maybe the hydrocodone that you took that night kind of conked you out, and you could care less if we got swept away or not.
I do recommend hydrocodone. I was gonna
bring up the hip thing because we wrote in Dear Bob and Sue season 3, and we also mentioned it in the podcast the first time with when we talked about Sahali Glacier, how you had a bad hip, and I'm sure I broke some HIPAA privacy laws when we were telling everyone about your medical procedures. But the fact is, you went on this 33-mile Chilkoot hike with a bad hip that was going to be replaced as soon as you got back.
Yeah, it was the next week. I was just trying to wear the last little bit of meat off it before I went in.
Well, we went in prior to both of those, Sahali Glacier and the Chilkoot hike, and looked at the calendar and when we were going to schedule it. And John said, the doctor, I got to do these two hikes. I'm not going to do them.
Yeah, so it's pretty amazing, actually, when you think about it. I mean, were you just like, you never complained? Were you just dying? And you weren't.
You'd never complain about that.
Well, that's true. The company I complained about.
You complain about everything else. That's what surprised me. You weren't complaining about your
hip. No, I'm going to say to our audience here that you did not take. You had the hydrocodone with you, but you never took it.
No.
You were. John was a high trooper. Threshold, right,
and I will say, yeah. I've said that, and we wrote this in the book. Mm. You were a trooper.
Yeah.
I don't know that I could have.
I wouldn't even thought that. About going on that hike if I had a bad hip.
It wasn't that tough, and it was, as it turns out, well worth it.
So the next morning, the Canyon City campsite is not in what used to be the old town site of Canyon City.
Of actual Canyon City.
Right. It's about, what, a half a mile down the trail?
Yeah, it's 0.7 miles. So what we did was we broke down camp, took down the tents, got our packs all ready to go, and then we left our packs at the warming hut.
Mm-hmm.
At the campsite, and then we hiked the 0.7 miles to the Canyon City site.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at one time in 1898, there was like 7 hotels and several saloons, and there was no sign of it when we hiked through there.
Yeah, I actually wrote it down. 8 hotels, 7 restaurants, 5 taverns, 2 supply stores, 2 barbershops, and a post office. And I guess one of the things was, too, that the river kind of rerouted itself and claimed some of that land and washed a lot of those things away.
Well, the other thing is that year, in order to get to Dawson City before freeze-up, the prospectors were hiking this trail in the snow, like February, March, April. And so they could get, that river was frozen. So they could get a lot of stuff up to Canyon City just on the frozen river. And it would be easier to drag it across the frozen river as opposed to like on the trail.
After we did our little tour of Canyon City, then I know you guys were anxious to get going on the trail because you wanted to get one of those tent platforms before everybody else got there. So we were practically running. Remember,
we were.
It was what, about 5 miles we had to cover that day, five and
a
half?
I do think we got started earlier than most people that day.
We did.
From Canyon City to Sheep Camp was a shorter day. It was 5.3 miles, mm-hmm. although it did have more elevation gain.
Yeah, there was some tough spots.
And like we were a little bit ahead of the other group.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the platforms. We haven't talked about this yet. There were no platforms at Canyon City, but at Sheep Camp, there are these 10-foot by 10-foot level wooden platforms, like a little deck, where you can put your tent.
Right, so you're off the ground.
So we didn't have any of those at Canyon City, but we were definitely looking forward to those
mm-hmm.
at Sheep Camp.
Yeah.
Was it pouring down rain that second day, too?
Yeah.
Had
yes,
it been. Yeah, so the
was.
Entire... Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was raining.
There was another spot where we had to walk. The trail was covered by the river. And we had to walk through that again.
Yeah, that's right.
And my boots that had gone from soaking wet when we got to Canyon City to wet.
Yeah.
Back to soaking.
And once we used up all the water that we started with, then we're like filtering and
you had that SteriPen.
Getting water out of the creeks. And mm-hmm. at this filter takes some time to get it out of the backpack and pump the filter. So I have this SteriPen, which is just a little UV light where you fill up your water bottle and then you turn the light on and you just like swirl it. It's like magic, which I don't know if it does anything.
We drank the water,
but
right?
But it okay.
Gave us like confidence that so we would fill our water bottles and we would stir it. And
for like 25 seconds, 25, 50.
It's not long, but I still think it's just magic.
Well, don't you remember later one of the rangers was saying that he never filters his water?
Right.
Yeah, I was having a hard time figuring out which of his three eyes to look at.
They're from Alaska. They have a stronger constitution. Remember, we're city folk pretending like we know what we're doing.
Yeah, we have to filter our water for sure. Now, when you first start to head into Sheep Camp, you pass this ranger station, which is actually a house that anywhere from two to three rangers live in. There's always a ranger at Sheep Camp. And then, you know, maybe a quarter mile past that, you actually get into camp.
Yeah, we're kind of surprised that we're looking after having gone to Canyon City and gotten the last campsite. Then we go to Sheep Camp and like every platform's open. So I think it was the only like hour and a half of the trip that it wasn't raining. And so we actually were able to set up our tents like in the sun.
Yeah.
For, I don't remember sun.
I don't remember sun either, but maybe the rain had stopped. They had that brand new.
They had nice facilities.
But it was brand new. Well,
there
right.
was a brand new warming hut that was roped off and we couldn't get into
it. I know.
Right, that was a bummer.
Looking at it from the outside.
That was a bummer. And then there was another shelter area with all the picnic tables.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm talking
about. Yeah. And there were two warming huts. With actual stoves.
Yeah, the older ones, the
tiny ones
that they had. And
with, they're like canvas tents. So we just kind of hung out throughout the afternoon.
Yeah, relaxed. And
relaxed at the picnic tables. I played cards.
Filled up. Then we did get the filter out and filled every water bottle.
Had an early, very salty, dehydrated dinner.
Those.
I love those.
Dehydrated dinners.
They get a little old after a while, right?
Have a lot of sodium.
This is what you like to cook. You like to chop and cook.
Yeah.
And I just want to boil some water and pour it in a bag and eat.
Well, we hung around because the ranger talk was at 7. And the ranger talk...
And that was mandatory.
...was mandatory because they're telling you what to expect the next day, which would be summit day. This is the hardest day of the hike. You're going up.
Was it Ranger Sean?
Yeah, we had... Three rangers. We had Sean, Al, and Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Ranger Sean, though, is the one that did the talk.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. He scared us. He scared me about what was coming up the next day.
Yeah.
Summit day. Basically, though, what surprised me was he said everyone has to be out and hiking by 6:30 a.m. That's pretty early to break down your tents, you know, have breakfast, to get do all that stuff by 6:30 in order to summit. And then make it
to the next,
which is another 4 miles past the summit. So it's,
well, they kept telling us that it's not over once you get to the summit. And, they emphasized this point because they said people, they think that's the hardest part and then they relax, but you still have 4 miles to go after the summit to get to the next camp. So you have to, you know, be prepared for that. And
And he was talking about the bears that were in the area.
There were bears in camp the night before. Yeah. Mama had treed her two cubs because they were worried about bigger bears that were in the neighborhood.
I felt like there was, it was less
of a... Which was very encouraging.
Yeah, that they like hanging out at the campsites.
When bears are hiding from other bears, that really makes you feel good when you're...
Yeah. So we didn't mention that sheep camp was one of the most important stops along the way for the gold seekers. And it was actually a huge town at one point. At its high point, it had between 6,000 and 8,000 people who actually lived there.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I mean, again, there were hotels and bars and restaurants and people sort of, I guess, rested there right before they tackled the golden staircase and climbing up over the summit. So anyway, we pretty much, after the ranger talk, we pretty much went to bed.
We're rule followers.
Yeah. And we knew we had to get up early. God, that was the worst night's sleep I have ever had. I don't think I slept a wink.
Well, again. Why is that? Was it because you're worried about bears or because we almost drowned?
Everything. Bears. The fact that it never stopped raining the entire night. And I was worried about trying to summit the pass the next morning. But yeah.
I slept pretty good. But when John and I woke up in the morning, there was like a foot of water and where our feet were.
Yeah, we were
in the tent
in water.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
our two sleeping pads, our blow up sleeping pads, were like little islands. There was about an inch of water all the way around the bottom of our tent, and all of our stuff was wet, and
it was a mess.
It didn't help that we had our fly on upside down, but it honestly didn't matter because everything was saturated and the water was just dripping through at that point.
It was one of those rains where, you know, it downpours. I think the downpour started, the heavy one started about 10 p.m. And I remember laying there thinking, well, a downpour like this can't last more than like a half an hour, and then it'll calm down. It downpoured, I think, till like 5 a.m.
Everything's bigger in Alaska.
Yeah, and we never got dry.
It never quit downpouring.
No. It's not a good sign when you have to wring your tent out the next day and you still can't get it dry.
But we were troopers. We got up.
We got up.
We got up at like
made
5.
Some coffee.
We got up 5:30. We went into that little community area that did have a roof. We could, you know, out of the rain, make some coffee. And I just remember, we had coffee. We might have had a little bit of breakfast, but I remember, John, you and I looked at each other like, oh, man, we have to go take those tents down. And it's just pouring rain. I mean, there's no shelter. We got to take the tents down, pack them up. We're going to get soaked doing it and strap them to our backpacks. And at some point, you're just like, okay, I'm going to be wet all day, so you might as well just do it.
Mm-hmm. I just remember thinking that this is going to be one of those days where you just have to put one foot in front of the other, mm-hmm, and just take what comes at you one little bit at a time, and things will get better later.
Didn't you guys feel like, so when we got into the picnic area, having, you know, make our coffee, the Germans were already there?
I know. They were on it.
Yeah. They were up and out. And
is it going to be the U.S. or Germany?
That's right. It was the Olympics.
And I think we were all packed up and on the trail at 6:30. And of course, I'm thinking, oh, they told us we have to be on the trail by 6:30. And we just barely made it. And everyone else is asleep in camp. Like no one else is up. And the Germans had beat us by a few minutes, and mm-hmm, we were on the trail at 6:30. Mm-hmm. And again, as hard as it's raining, I remember thinking we were not only were we not cold, we were a little warm. Yeah. We had our rain jackets on, which made no sense. Like, just open them up because you're as soaked on the inside as the outside. Yeah.
So what we were looking at that day was it was going to be 3.5 miles up to the summit. Now that's about 2,500 feet elevation gain. But at one point they told us there's an area that is 1/2 mile long and 1,000 feet elevation gain. And that's steep. In addition to that, you're also going hand and foot over boulders. At some point there is no trail. It's just a jumble of boulders and scree. So you're kind of picking your way over that. And they said oftentimes it's foggy up there and you can't see more than, you know, 10 yards in front of your face. So, woohoo.
I know. And don't you remember the night before the guy said, because the Canadian ranger at the top radioed down and said he had never seen weather like this.
I know.
It's the worst he's ever seen
ever
it in
seen.
His 25 years or whatever.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Plus, as we mentioned earlier, once we would get to the top, we still had 4 more miles to get to the next camp. Right. So, yeah, we were looking at a big day.
Well, yeah, so we have all these things to worry about. And I know, Lolly, you were worried about the bears. I wasn't, more just being naive than anything else. But the night before, Al had said, well, the bears really like, this time of year, they really like the berries that grow on the Devil's Club plants. And they'll pull that stalk off and they'll eat the berries. And just as we get going on the trail, we see all of these Devil's Club stalks on the trail. So we knew bears had been there, you know, minutes before. So that actually made me a little bit worried.
Well, the other part is that first part of the trail, when you leave Sheep's Camp, you're not hiking through some big open area. It's like you're walking down a hallway with shrubs on both sides and alder trees and perfect bear attack.
Hey, bear.
Bear ambush.
Yeah. And like luckily for us, John was in the lead.
John was leading. And then I think it was me. And then you, Karen, and Matt was taking rear. But we were all saying, hey, bear.
It was nerve-wracking. Because, you could not see what was around the next corner.
The best part is I knew even with a bad hip, I wasn't the slowest one in the group.
I will admit, I was the slowest one.
On top of
worrying about bears and the rain and the hard hike and all of these things, for some reason I was cramping up, and I had been cramping up for like a day, and I couldn't figure out what it was. I thought it was dehydration, but then I drank a ton of water. So I was in the rear because I was barely moving.
I know. It was not a great start. And then as we got through that scrubby part and we got closer to the river, we could hear, do you guys remember?
Right.
We could hear those booms of thunder.
We kept thinking, guys, the thunder is loud. I mean, it's been raining for a few days, but we hadn't heard thunder like this. And then we realized, the thunder's not coming from the sky. And eventually we figured out that the Taya River, which is essentially what you're hiking up, the Taya River, the boulders in the river were dislodging and rolling down the river. That's what the thunder was.
Mm-hmm. They're hitting each other in the river. It was crazy.
It wasn't just like sprinkling. It was full-on downpour. And we just had our head to the ground and just hiking through. We're hearing rocks roll down the river. Mm-hmm. We're saying, hey, bear. Matt has to stop because he's, you know, there's a lot going against us, right? But we just kept plugging through.
Then there was that one spot. Remember, we hiked right next to the Taya River, and the river kept rising, and it was just a couple of feet away from the trail.
Right.
And you could tell that normally the trail was pretty far from the river, but that morning the river,
and
anyone slipped and fell.
Oh, yeah, because we were stair-stepping up these boulders that were obviously very wet and slippery right next to this raging river. If any of us would have slipped, you'd never see
it. Would have been so pretty if the clouds had lifted, because we were out of that shrub area and we got above the tree line, so things were a little bit more open, although it was very socked in. But you could I was less worried about the bears there because you could kind of see in the distance was going on.
Right. Yeah. And so we had mountains. So we were going up through a valley, essentially. And those mountains on both sides, remember all the waterfalls that were cascading down those mountains?
Yeah.
That was beautiful.
And we were by ourselves. We didn't see anybody.
No.
You know, we're just...
Not
we
until.
Because we were rule followers.
Well, we got maybe 200-300 yards out of tree line, above tree line. And they had told us the night before, there's a small creek that you could just splash through. Your feet might get wet. They literally said that. Your feet might get wet. Just splash through that. And then right after that, you'll reach the bottom of the hard part of the hike. And we get to that little creek, and it was
was a river.
It was a river. It was a torrent.
And the Germans were there.
They had stopped. Yes, they were.
I thought they were stopped because they were having a snack. They were stopped because they couldn't figure out how to cross this now raging new river that had appeared.
So all of the runoff from the mountains, and of course above this area, there's no vegetation, there's no trees, so the water is just cascading off of these rocks and mountains and forming this river that we were now faced with. We could not figure out how to get across that. And John,
the Germans had told us they had went up and down the river trying to find a safe place to, and they looked at us and, you know.
Well, the great part was, if I remember correctly, wind was probably blowing about 30 miles an hour and the rain was sideways.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
And we're talking to the Germans who didn't speak English. To try to figure out how and what they had decided to do. And then, Matt, you and I decided that we would just see whether or not somehow get across. And I remember taking like two steps into that river, and you stepped in behind me, and the girls are yelling.
We are freaking.
The girls are yelling. The girls are screaming.
Telling me to get out, and I'm like, well, I would if I could turn around without falling down.
It was such a stupid thing to do. And
well, because what we didn't mention is, if you can picture this river that John's now trying to cross, it's going downhill and it meets up with the huge Taya River. So if you were to fall, which would be very easy to happen, if you were to fall, you'd get swept down into the Taya and you'd be swept off and we would never see you again. So it's not just like you could fall and get wet. If you fall, you're a goner. Yeah. It was the scariest thing I've ever seen.
That's not an exaggeration.
No,
not an exaggeration.
Like it's not maybe you would get swept down. You would have been gone.
It was a river. It wasn't a creek.
Yeah, and like Karen said, it was at a slope. So you see John and Matt go in, and they're like, and there's boulders flying down the river.
I went in to just like grab John. I grabbed John's pack just in case.
Yeah, like you could hang on to John's
John
via his pack.
Went down.
Yeah.
There was a chance, and the boulders and gravel were washing away from under my feet. That was the problem, is there was no place to step that wasn't being washed away. And so if we finally get, Lolly's yelling and
Germans are just like looking at us like we're nuts.
We finally like back away and the four of us are standing on this edge of this river, and I remember a boulder just like dislodges and starts rolling down the river, and that boulder was at least 1,000 pounds, and it just like washed down the river like it was styrofoam.
Well, the funny thing is, I mean, let's say you and John, Matt, made it across the river. There was no way I was going to put one toe in that river.
No,
we had a little
never.
Grandbaby due in October, and I was not going not see that new grandbaby.
I know.
Of ours.
In fact, and we wrote this in the book because this stuck with me, is you and I were, well, we're kind of laughing, crying, more crying. And you said, I don't know if you remember this, you said, I am not dying for this.
No.
You said, I need to meet my grandson.
Little grandbaby. Not my day to die, MF-er.
That's right. And so, I mean, we kind of weighed our options, right? We kept looking at it and trying to figure out.
We waited for a little bit, but the longer we stood there, the colder we got.
And the more the river was rising.
Well, the other thing is, we were worried about that one part of the river that had started to flood the trail on our way up, that we were going to get trapped between where we were and sheep camp. We wouldn't be able to get back to it.
Well, the other thing is, if for some reason we got across the creek now/river, there was another
larger creek. We didn't know what was ahead of us.
Well, I thought they told us at the...
That there were two crossings.
Yeah, there was two crossings.
Well, there was no... There was also no flat spot to put a tent. Like, even if we had to hunker down and try to like
down
put
there, yeah, put,
there,
no.
there was no flat. No. It was boulders.
No,
it was scree.
No shelter.
Plus, the Germans had drank all their beer, so they weren't going to get much help from them.
So the Germans, they came to the conclusion, and the talking to the guide who spoke some English, he just kept saying, "Not good, not good." And so they hightailed it back down towards sheep camp. We followed pretty quick, but we stood there looking at that river for a while, thinking, God, there's got to be a way to get it.
We went upstream, downstream, tried to cross it.
Yeah.
But then I remember after a while, we were so, because we'd been standing there for so long, it was freezing. The wind was howling. Our teeth were
up there. It did get very cold.
Yeah. We were drenched. I was through to my underwear.
Yeah. So we thought, okay, we got to get back below these rivers before we get trapped between two.
Yeah.
And then, so we're going back down towards sheep camp, and now we're running into the hikers coming up.
Yes. The rest of them.
And we kept telling them, like, it's not crossable. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you need to be super careful. You should really turn around. And no one turned around.
No, but they wanted to go see for themselves. Yeah, you know, so I get that. You know, Matt and Karen and John Lally aren't going to tell me I can't cross the river.
They wanted to go look at it. Yeah.
And then we hiked a little bit further to that spot where the Taya River was encroaching on the trail, and when we got there,
it was over the trail
and rushing.
Yeah,
and I think it was about 2 feet deep there, and
so
scary. Then we were looking at that, thinking, "Okay, we are trapped." And then some hikers came up, and they just tromped right through it. So then we could see how deep it was, and so we just got through it.
And we kept telling people, "Not going to be able to, you know,
turn around, it's not possible."
And we didn't tell them that they couldn't get through. We said we decided we weren't going to try to get through.
Yeah.
It's dangerous.
It wasn't
very
worth it.
It's not worth risking your life over, for sure.
Well, as it turned out, and we didn't know this at the time, it's historic levels of rain. It's historic floods.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like trees were down at the
We were part of history.
Uh-huh. They had actually closed the access to the Chilkoot Trail to new hikers.
Come to find out.
They shut it off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to make a long story short, we did get back then to sheep camp.
And we ran to the ranger.
We went to the ranger station, and
we were freezing. They welcomed us in with open arms.
So we go into the ranger station, and I think, I don't know what they were thinking, but it seemed like they were thinking, you know, here's four older campers or hikers. They couldn't quite make it, and now they're coming back down, and we're telling this story. Oh, the creek was really high, and we didn't think we could get across. And so they invited us in, and they were very calm. They offered us warm water with honey in it. And they were not like in a hurry to like check it out. And finally, we showed them the video.
Yeah, Karen took a video
of the
there.
River. Yeah. And just then they're like, uh-oh.
We got to get up there.
They started calling on the radio.
There's walkie-talkies going. They're putting on all their gear.
They called the Canadian Ranger at the top.
Yeah. The Canadian Ranger's like, this is treacherous.
Treacherous.
And on the Canadian side, they had to then come down and start rescuing people.
You know, the other thing, too, remember, there's a group coming in behind us from Canyon City. I mean, if all these people were not going to make it over the pass, all these people were going to come back down and have to camp at sheep camp again. And then people are coming in. So it was just kind of this pandemonium.
Yes.
What's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Where are we going to sleep? But we felt like we were the first ones back so we could get a prime spot in one of those tent.
And we did get a prime spot. Remember, so the rangers offered us the the trail crew cabins.
Well, they were hesitant to make the offer because I think that they were only allowed to do this in emergencies, which, as it turned out, this was an emergency. But the trail crew has some fixed canvas cabins close by the ranger station, and they said, since everyone else is coming behind you and there's no place for you to camp, you can spend the night in one of these.
Felt like we were in a hotel.
Which was great because our tents were soaked through.
Yeah, but remember the four of us were stuck in a two.
It was 8 feet by 8 feet,
and
the four of us.
We thought the four of us
were
in there.
I was thinking,
okay, well, it'll be Matt, Karen, me, and then John all lined up in a row. I'll end up spooning Karen.
We're perfectly happy with that.
I was grateful to have a roof over
my head. I wasn't going to spoon
John.
And then didn't the ranger come by and says, you know, you could take two of these if you want.
Yeah, because there were probably, a half a dozen of those little cabins. So we each had our own, and it was like the Ritz-Carlton in my mind.
But the crazy thing is, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking, and maybe Matt, you're going to cover this, but I just remember once we kind of got settled in there, I'm thinking all these people we had passed on a trail are now going to start showing up here, and we've got the primo real estate, and nobody shows up.
Nobody.
I know.
So it was the Germans who were back.
Yeah. The Germans were back, and we were back. The people that had actually followed the rules and had gotten out of camp by 6:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, the next morning, they opened the trail back up, back in the direction of Dai. So as soon as we found that out, we hiked. We just decided that we're going to make a beeline. And that day, we hiked all 13 miles.
I know, but I thought we were going to be hiking with those rangers. Remember, we became fast friends with them.
Oh, yeah. we were best friends.
Best friends with them, and they wanted to hike out with us, remember?
You thought they were going to escort us out.
I thought we'd be like, you know, big old group of fast friends. They took off in...
Well, yeah, they're like 20-something. They can hike 10 times
faster. And they wanted to make sure they got out before the trail closed again.
Yeah, and
we didn't see them at all. Really poor Al. Al had to stay.
Yeah, Al stayed. There were new replacements coming in to help her. But the reason we didn't try to summit the next day was because, you know, we had specific camping reservations for each night. So we didn't have camping reservations for that following night. And we had train tickets to get out of there on a specific day. So we couldn't just say, oh, we'll go the next day because the camps are full with other people.
Yeah.
So that's why we decided we were done with the Chilkoot. And we hiked that 13 miles out. We could have stayed at Canyon City.
We could have. We stopped there and finished our wine, Karen.
Which was another good decision that we made.
But we were further than Canyon City.
We were further.
But the thing that kept me going on that 13 miles out, because that was a long way to go in one day with those heavy packs, the thing that kept me going was just thinking of sleeping in a bed in a hotel room and going to the brewery and like taking a shower and being clean. So like we were going to get that 13 miles in no matter what.
We got out around 4. Would you say 4 or 5?
Yeah, it was 4 or 5. Yeah. And then, of course, we didn't have a ride.
Right,
we didn't have a place to stay.
As we got back to the trailhead, Lolly, you got a cell signal and you called the White House.
Yeah, we got a room.
And, in Skagway, not the White House, the bed and breakfast in Skagway, and got the same rooms that we had, you know, two nights before. Mm-hmm.
And we called Troy.
And then we called Troy.
God love him.
And he came and picked us up.
Yeah, he gave us a ride back into town, gave him back his bear spray.
That's right. And we showered. And oh my gosh, it was so great.
And then we went to, as what you would do after you've a near-death experience, we went to the brewery.
Yeah.
To have a beer and a hamburger. Mm-hmm.
Well, more than just a beer.
Yeah. But I remember, too, I was so done with the Chilkoot Trail at that point. I didn't want to think about it, talk about it. I was going to erase it from my mind. And all of a sudden, after a beer or two, the three of you are like, you know, we'll have to come back and do it again.
You cannot do something that you're supposed to finish. You have to finish
it. It's pretty lame to go halfway up and turn around. And then that's the end of the story. We're not ever doing it again. No, we got to do it again. So now as we're talking, it's mid 2020. We do have permits.
This summer.
We're going to go this summer and
we'll see.
Give it another whack if
it's open.
If everything's open.
Mm-hmm. Who knows what will happen this time? It sure was fun to have John and Lolly on the show, wasn't it? talking about what happened.
Some friends and some other voices other than just you and I looking at each other across the microphones.
Exactly. And the next day, we kind of had a free day in Skagway. So, you know, we had fun. We went to some of the bookstores and a distillery. But you know what? It was killing us to know what had happened to all the rest of the people who actually made it over that river. Like,
well, how exactly did they do it? Because when we were there, it looked treacherous and impossible. And we kept suggesting to people to turn back. And they all got through.
I know. So the next day we finally got our answer on our early morning boat ride from Skagway back to Juneau. We ran into some other people who had been in our hiking group of 40. It was a man from Utah who was hiking it with his brother and his teenage son. So we had some conversations with them in the first 2 days, you know, where are you from? What are you guys doing? So we kind of had a friendship with them, and we saw them passing us on the trail up to that raging river. So when we saw him on the boat, we said, "What happened? How did you get through?"
And they described it to us.
Uh-huh. They told us the story.
They said they had gotten to the creek and it was swollen and water was rushing. They were not in the mood to turn back. They were less cautious than us, mm-hmm. and they searched high and low for a place to cross the river. And they found that there was one spot that the creek had come down just enough that they thought that they could jump over. And so they were looking at it. And I guess that one, while they're contemplating, should we take our lives in our hands and jump over this part of the creek? One of the party.
His brother, the big dude.
took his backpack and threw it across the creek. And said, "Okay, well, my pack's now on the other side, so we don't have a choice." Mm-hmm. And they found, they described how they made a little bit of a bridge out of a branch that they had found, and they were holding on to each other as they crossed. And then other people had gotten to the trail. They hooked arms and went across. There was actually even like a 8-year-old girl that was within one of the groups and a grandmother. I think what had happened after hearing all these stories is the creek had come down considerably, mm-hmm. because there was no spot along that creek that you could jump over. You couldn't even walk to a spot that you could jump over. And I think in our maybe lack of experience and a little bit panic, mm-hmm. we were concerned that flood was just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and we would be trapped up there. And we came down. We were there right at the peak.
Right.
We were at the highest water level. And probably had we stayed there another half hour or an hour, mm-hmm. if we hadn't froze to death, the creek probably would have come down enough for us to mm-hmm. figure out a way to get across. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the thing is, as he continued his story, it was not all smooth sailing once they crossed. So, of course, it's still raining. I guess that this family that had the little girl and the grandmother, they were from Whitehorse, and the little girl was suffering from hypothermia, and the grandmother was suffering from exhaustion. So they had to have people carry their packs. The Canadian Rangers came down and helped, and basically everyone helped them get up to the pass where there is an emergency shelter up there.
Right. On the Canadian side, the Parks Canada has some structures, and there was one, and they don't let people ever sleep there. This mm-hmm. is not, it's only available like in extreme emergencies, which this was. A lot of the people who crossed, not just that family, but others, had to stay in that structure, and they said, yeah, they were in there like sardines, just mm-hmm. like one, you know, next to each other, spending the night. So it wasn't like the rest of the hikers all got across the creek and made it to Happy Camp.
Right.
Most of them didn't even make it to Happy Camp.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, so the man from Utah told us that out of our group of 42, he said 14 people made it to Happy Camp that night. So that's not very many. So, you know, it was certainly an adventure for every single person who was on that, you know, who was doing the summit that day. And not just us, but everybody had an adventure for sure.
Right. And thankfully, everyone was fine. Hypothermia was the worst thing that happened. Easily, if somebody had been a little bit too brave, they could have gotten swept away. So it was a good day for everyone that no one got seriously hurt.
Definitely, definitely. So we had built in an extra day in Juneau on the backside of this trip because we were hoping to go to see the Mendenhall Glacier and maybe do some kayaking. But of course, that free day that we had, it was still pouring rain. But we went back to the Alaska State Archives. We've written about that now in Dear Bob and Sue Season 2 and 3. And it's just this amazing resource in this museum in Juneau. And we were able to look at some of the actual things, artifacts from the Chilkoot Trail.
It's a beautiful building that they built. It's only a few years old. The Alaska State Museum has the first floor and incredible exhibits there, and so that's worth seeing. And then a couple of floors above, it's the archives, and we were able to ask for a couple of the boxes from the archives that contain some diaries, and we're able to very, very carefully take a couple of the diaries out of the box and look at them and look at the entries. And it was pretty amazing to see these 120-year-old archives and some of the notes that people wrote, and having been on that exact trail and experience a little bit of what they experienced. It was fun to see that history. It really brought it to life.
It did. And holding these little diaries were, you know, very small pocket-sized leather-bound diaries. And when you looked at them, of course, they're all handwritten in cursive in the tiniest, most perfect handwriting you've ever seen. And of course, we also saw they included lists of supplies that they had purchased. Right. And it was we could have spent a week there looking at all of these. It was really incredible. And as you said, it really brought the whole experience home.
Right. So if you're ever in Juneau, definitely check out the Alaska State Museum and the archives.
Yeah. So that is our story of our misadventure up there. Of course, we do, as we mentioned, we do have permits to go back this summer of 2020. We're not sure if that's going to happen. The trail is currently closed, so we're waiting to see if it's going to reopen. Of course, we're going back with John and Lolly. And you know, we'll see what happens.
And John has a new hip, so everything should, and we're a little bit wiser, a little bit. So
that's
maybe
right.
We'll get across and have a whole nother story.
That's right. And we'll have John and Lolly back, and we'll have Hiking the Chilkoot Trail Part 2.
We'll be back with our mailbag segment in the next episode. So if you have a question for us, you can send us an email to mattandkarensmith@gmail.com or reach out to us on social media. You can go to facebook.com/dearbobandess, or you can find us on Instagram @mattandkarensmith. We'll review all the questions that come in, and we'll be answering some of them in our mailbag segment on future episodes.
To see pictures from the Chilkoot Trail, go to www.thedearbobandsuepodcast.com and click on the title for episode 12. There you'll find show notes for this episode and links to other information.
We want to thank all of you who've left us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. In our last episode, we asked listeners to help us get from 277 to 300 ratings and reviews, and so many of you responded. We are almost there. We're so, so close. Now, you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts, even if you listened on Google Podcasts, Spotify, or another podcast app.
Do you get a prize if you get 300 ratings? I wonder, like, did you make a bet with somebody? Is that why? I don't know where this 300 rating.
Well, not saying is once we hit 300, then it's going to be 500.
I see. You're kidding. So you're going to keep asking for more. The books that this podcast is based on are available on Amazon.com. Just search for Dear Bob and Sue. And you can also find more information about us by heading over to www.dearbobandsue.com.
Our show is produced by our amazing team at Puddle Creative in Portland, Oregon, who went above and beyond for this particular episode, trying to make the four of us sound, I don't know what, like real
intelligent.
Yeah, intelligent. Our artwork is by the designers at Expert Subjects, and our theme music is by Will West. Hopefully, when we go back up to Alaska, we'll be a little more successful than we were last time.
Yeah, but before we go, we need to figure out why Alaska keeps trying to kill us.